Chapter 48 and 21. Washington, January 1, 1821. To the House of Representatives of the United States. In compliance with the resolution of the House of Representatives of the 22nd of November last, requesting the President to inform that House what naval force has been stationed for the protection of the commerce of our citizens in the West India Islands and parts adjacent during the present year, and whether any depredations by pirates or others upon the property of citizens of the United States engaged in such commerce have been reported to our government. I now submit for the information of the House a report from the Secretary of the Navy, with accompanying documents, which contains all the information in the possession of the government required by that resolution. James Monroe, Washington, January 4, 1821. To the House of Representatives. I communicate to the House of Representatives a report from the Secretary of State, which, with the papers accompanying it, contains all the information in the possession of the executive requested by a resolution of the House of the 4th of December last, in the subject of the African slave trade. James Monroe, Washington, January 4, 1821. To the House of Representatives. In compliance with the resolution of the House of Representatives of the 15th of December last, requesting the President of the United States to cause to be laid before that House a statement of expenditures and receipts in the Indian Department, also the nature and extent of the contracts entered into, and with whom, from the 2nd of March, 1811, to the present period, I now transmit a letter from the Secretary of War, with a report of the Superintendent of Indian Trade, which contains the information desired. James Monroe, Washington, January 12, 1821. To the House of Representatives of the United States. I transmit to the House of Representatives a report from the Secretary of State, with the enclosed documents, relating to the negotiation for the suppression of the slave trade, which should have accompanied a message on that subject communicated to the House some time since, but which were accidentally omitted. James Monroe, Washington, January 18, 1821. To the Senate of the United States. In compliance with the resolution of the Senate of the 4th instant, requesting the President of the United States to communicate to the Senate any information he may have as to the power or authority which belonged to Don John Bonaventure Morales and to the Baron currently to grant and dispose of the lands of Spain in Louisiana previously to the year 1803, I transmit a report from the Secretary of the Treasury, submitting a letter of the Commissioner of the General Land Office, with the document to which it refers. James Monroe, Washington, January 18, 1821. To the House of Representatives. In compliance with the resolution of the House of Representatives requesting the President to inform the House, if in his opinion proper, whether any, and, if any, what, negotiations, since the 1st of January, 1816, have been had with the Six Nations of Indians, or any portion of them, who the commissioners or agents were, the objects of the negotiation, the expenses of the same, the compensation of each commissioner, secretary, or agent, and to whom the monies were paid, I now transmit a report from the Secretary of War communicating the information desired. James Monroe, Washington, January 31, 1821. To the Senate and House of Representatives. I transmit to Congress a report from the Secretary of the Treasury submitting copies of the instructions given to the commissioners appointed under the Act of the 15th of May, 1820, authorizing the location of a road from Wheeling, in the state of Virginia, to a point in the left bank of the Mississippi River between St. Louis and the mouth of the Illinois River, and copies of the report made by the said commissioners to the Treasury Department of the progress they have made in the execution of the duties prescribed by the said Act, together with maps of the country through which the location is to be made. James Monroe, February 5, 1821. To the Senate of the United States. I herewith transmit, in confidence, to the Senate reports from the Secretary of State and of the Treasury, with the papers containing the correspondence and the information in possession of the government, the communication of which was requested by the resolution of the Senate of the 23rd of last month. It is desired that the original letters may, when the Senate shall have no further use for them, be returned. James Monroe, February 8, 1821. To the Senate of the United States. In compliance with the resolution of the Senate of the 1st instant, requesting the President of the United States to cause to be laid before the Senate any information he may have in relation to the claims of citizens of Georgia against the great nation of Indians, and why these claims, if any exist, have not been heretofore adjusted and settled under the provisions of the treaties of 1790 and 1796. I now transmit a report from the Secretary of War, with accompanying documents, which contains all the information on this subject in the possession of the Executive. James Monroe, February 14, 1821. To the Senate of the United States. The ratification by the Spanish government of the Treaty of Amity, Settlement, and limits between the United States and Spain, signed in the 22nd of February, 1819, and in the 24th of that month ratified in the part of the United States, has been received by the envoy extraordinary and minister plenipotentiary of that power at this place, who has given notice that he is ready to exchange the ratifications. By the 16th article of that treaty it was stipulated that the ratifications should be exchanged within 6 months from the day of its signature, which time having elapsed before the ratification of Spain was given, a copy and translation thereof are now transmitted to the Senate for their advice and consent to receive it in exchange for the ratification of the United States heretofore executed. The treaty was submitted to the consideration of the Cortes of that kingdom before its ratification, which was finally given with their assent and sanction. The correspondence between the Spanish Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Minister of the United States at Madrid in that occasion is also herewith communicated to the Senate, together with a memorandum by the Secretary of State of his conference with the Spanish envoy here yesterday, when that minister gave notice of his readiness to exchange the ratifications. The return of the original papers now transmitted, to avoid the delay necessary to the making of copies, is requested. James Monroe, Washington, February 22, 1821. To the Senate of the United States. In compliance with the resolution of the Senate of the 16th instant, requesting the President of the United States to cause to be laid before the Senate the original order for building the barracks at Sackett's Harbor, together with all communications between the War Department and Major General Brown relative thereto, and the amount of public monies expended thereon, I now transmit a report from the Secretary of War, with the papers enclosed, which contains the information desired. James Monroe, Washington, February 22, 1821. To the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States. The Treaty of Amity, Settlement, and Limits between the United States and Spain, signed in the 22nd of February, 1819, having been ratified by the contracting parties, and the ratifications having been exchanged, it is herewith communicated to Congress, that such legislative measures may be taken, as they shall judge proper for carrying the same into execution. James Monroe, Washington, February 24, 1821. To the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States. I transmit to Congress a letter from the Secretary of War, enclosing an annual return of the militia of the United States, prepared by the Adjutant and Inspector General conformably to the militia laws in that subject. James Monroe, Washington, February 28, 1821. To the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States. I herewith transmit to Congress certain extracts and a copy of letters received by the Secretary of State from the Marshal of the United States for the Eastern District of Virginia, in relation to the execution of the Act of the 14th of March, 1820, to provide for taking the Fourth Census, together with the answers returned to that Marshal by the Secretary of State. As the time within which the assistants of the marshals can legally make their returns expired in the first Monday of the present month, it would appear by the information from the marshal at Richmond that the completion of the fourth census, as it respects the Eastern District of Virginia, will have been defeated not only, as it regards the period contemplated by law, but during the whole of the current year, unless Congress, to whom the case is submitted, should by an act of the present session allow further time for making the returns in question. As connected with this subject, it is also submitted for the consideration of Congress how far the marshals ought to be liable to the payment of postage in the conveyance of the papers concerning the census and manufactures by the mail. In one instance it has been already ascertained that this item of contingent expense will amount to nearly a moiety of the compensation of the marshal for the whole of his services. If the marshals are to be relieved from this charge, provision will be necessary by law either for the admission of it in their accounts or the refunding of it by the respective postmasters. James Monroe, Washington, March 2nd. 1821. To the Congress of the United States. I communicate to the two houses of Congress copies of a treaty this day ratified in the part of the United States, concluded and signed at the Indian Springs on the 8th of January last, with the Creek Nation of Indians, in order to such legislative measures as may be necessary for giving effect to it. James Monroe, Washington, March 3, 1821. To the House of Representatives of the United States. The treaty concluded between the United States and the Kickapoo tribe of Indians on the 30th of July, 1820, having been ratified by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, I now lay a copy of the said treaty before the House of Representatives in order to such legislative provisions being made, as may be necessary to carry into effect the stipulations therein contained in the part of the United States. James Monroe, Second Inaugural Address. Fellow citizens, I shall not attempt to describe the grateful emotions which the new and very distinguished proof of the confidence of my fellow citizens, evinced by my re-election to this high trust, has excited in my bosom. The approbation which it announces of my conduct in the preceding term affords me a consolation which I shall profoundly feel through life. The general accord with which it has been expressed adds to the great and never-ceasing obligations which it imposes. To merit the continuance of this good opinion, and to carry it with me into my retirement as the solace of advancing years, will be the object of my most zealous and unceasing efforts. Having no pretensions to the high and commanding claims of my predecessors, whose names are so much more conspicuously identified with our revolution, and who contributed so preeminently to promote its success, I consider myself rather, as the instrument than the cause of the union which has prevailed in the late election. In surmounting, in favor of my humble pretensions, the difficulties which so often produce division in like occurrences, it is obvious that other powerful causes, indicating the great strength and stability of our union, have essentially contributed to draw you together. That these powerful causes exist, and that they are permanent, is my fixed opinion. That they may produce a like accord in all questions touching, however remotely, the liberty, prosperity, and happiness of our country, will always be the object of my most fervent prayers to the supreme offer of all good. In a government which is founded by the people, who possess exclusively the sovereignty, it seems proper that the person who may be placed by their suffrages in this high trust should declare on commencing its duties the principles in which he intends to conduct the administration. If the person thus elected has served the preceding term, an opportunity is afforded him to review its principal occurrences and to give such further explanation respecting them, as in his judgment may be useful to his constituents. The events of 1 year have influence on those of another, and, in like manner, of a preceding on the succeeding administration. The movements of a great nation are connected in all their parts. If errors have been committed, they ought to be corrected. If the policy is sound, it ought to be supported. It is by a thorough knowledge of the whole subject that our fellow citizens are enabled to judge correctly of the past and to give a proper direction to the future. Just before the commencement of the last term, the United States had concluded a war with a very powerful nation in conditions equal and honorable to both parties. The events of that war are too recent and too deeply impressed on the memory of all to require a development from me. Our commerce had been in a great measure driven from the sea. Our Atlantic and inland frontiers were invaded in almost every part. The waste of life along our coast and in some parts of our inland frontiers, to the defense of which our gallant and patriotic citizens were called, was immense. In addition to which not less than $120 million were added at its end to the public debt. As soon as the war had terminated, the nation, admonished by its events, resolved to place itself in a situation which should be better calculated to prevent the recurrence of a like evil, and, in case it should recur, to mitigate its calamities. With this view, after reducing our land force to the basis of a peace establishment, which has been further modified, since provision was made for the construction of fortifications at proper points through the whole extent on our coast and such an augmentation on our naval force, as should be well adapted to both purposes. The laws making this provision were passed in 1815 and 1816. And it has been, since, the constant effort of the executive to carry them into effect. The advantage of these fortifications and of an augmented naval force in the extent contemplated, in a point of economy, has been fully illustrated by a report of the Board of Engineers and Naval Commissioners lately communicated to Congress, by which it appears that in an invasion by 20,000 men, with a correspondent naval force, in a campaign of 6 months only, the whole expense of the construction of the works would be defrayed by the difference in the sum necessary to maintain the force which would be adequate to our defense with the aid of those works and that which would be incurred without them. The reason of this difference is obvious. If fortifications are judiciously placed on our great inlets, as distant from our cities as circumstances will permit, they will form the only points of attack, and the enemy will be detained there by a small regular force a sufficient time to enable our militia to collect and repair to that in which the attack is made. A force adequate to the enemy, collected at that single point, with suitable preparation for such others as might be menaced, is all that would be requisite. But if there were no fortifications, then the enemy might go where he pleased, and, changing his position and sailing from place to place. Our force must be called out and spread in vast numbers along the whole coast and in both sides of every bay and river, as high up in each as it might be navigable for ships of war. By these fortifications, supported by our navy, to which they would afford like support, we should present to other powers an armed front from St. Croix to the Sabine, which would protect in the event of war our whole coast and interior from invasion, and even in the wars of other powers, in which we were neutral, they would be found eminently useful, as, by keeping their public ships at a distance from our cities, peace and order in them would be preserved and the government be protected from insult. It need scarcely be remarked that these measures have not been resorted to in a spirit of hostility to other powers. Such a disposition does not exist toward any power. Peace and good will have been, and will hereafter be, cultivated with all, and by the most faithful regard to justice. They have been dictated by a love of peace, of economy, and an earnest desire to save the lives of our fellow citizens from that destruction and our country from that devastation which are inseparable from war when it finds us unprepared for it. It is believed, and experience has shown, that such a preparation is the best expedient that can be resorted to prevent war. I add with much pleasure that considerable progress has already been made in these measures of defense, and that they will be completed in a few years, considering the great extent and importance of the object, if the plan be zealously and steadily persevered in. The conduct of the government in what relates to foreign powers is always an object of the highest importance to the nation. Its agriculture, commerce, manufactures, fisheries, revenue, in short, its peace, may all be affected by it. Attention is therefore due to this subject. At the period adverted to the powers of Europe, after having been engaged in long and destructive wars with each other, had concluded a peace, which happily still exists. Our peace with the power with whom we had been engaged had also been concluded. The war between Spain and the colonies in South America, which had commenced many years before, was then the only conflict that remained unsettled. This being a contest between different parts of the same community, in which other powers had not interfered, was not affected by their accommodations. This contest was considered at an early stage by my predecessor a civil war in which the parties were entitled to equal rights in our ports. This decision, the first made by any power, being formed in great consideration of the comparative strength and resources of the parties, the length of time, and successful opposition made by the colonies, and of all other circumstances in which it ought to depend, was in strict accord with the law of nations. Congress has invariably acted in this principle, having made no change in our relations with either party. Our attitude has therefore been that of neutrality between them, which has been maintained by the government with the strictest impartiality. No aid has been afforded to either, nor has any privilege been enjoyed by the one which has not been equally open to the other party, and every exertion has been made in its power to enforce the execution of the laws prohibiting illegal equipments with equal rigor against both. By this equality between the parties, their public vessels have been received in our ports in the same footing. They have enjoyed an equal right to purchase and export arms, munitions of war, and every other supply, the exportation of all articles whatever being permitted under laws which were passed long before the commencement of the contest. Our citizens have traded equally with both, and their commerce with each has been alike protected by the government. Respecting the attitude which it may be proper for the United States to maintain hereafter between the parties, I have no hesitation in stating it, as my opinion that the neutrality heretofore observed should still be adhered to. From the change in the government of Spain and the negotiation now depending, invited by the Cortes and accepted by the colonies, it may be presumed that their differences will be settled in the terms proposed by the colonies. Should the war be continued, the United States, regarding its occurrences, will always have it in their power to adopt such measures respecting it, as their honor and interest may require. Shortly after the general peace, a band of adventurers took advantage of this conflict and of the facility which it afforded to establish a system of buccaneering in the neighboring seas, to the great annoyance of the commerce of the United States, and, as was represented, of that of other powers. Of this spirit and of its injurious bearing on the United States, strong proofs were afforded by the establishment at Amelia Island, and the purposes to which it was made instrumental by this band in 1817, and by the occurrences which took place in other parts of Florida in 1818, the details of which in both instances are too well known to require to be now recited. I am satisfied had a less decisive course been adopted that the worst consequences would have resulted from it. We have seen that these checks, decisive as they were not sufficient to crush that piratical spirit. Many culprits brought within our limits have been condemned to suffer death, the punishment due to that atrocious crime. The decisions of upright and enlightened tribunals fall equally on all whose crimes subject them, by a fair interpretation of the law, to its censure. It belongs to the executive not to suffer the executions under these decisions to transcend the great purpose, for which punishment is necessary. The full benefit of example being secured, policy as well as humanity equally forbids that this should be carried further. I have acted in this principle, pardoning those who appear to have been led astray by ignorance of the criminality of the acts they had committed, and suffering the law to take effect on those only in whose favor no extenuating circumstances could be urged. Great confidence is entertained that the late treaty with Spain, which has been ratified by both the parties, and the ratifications whereof have been exchanged, has placed the relations of the two countries in a basis of permanent friendship. The provision made by it for such of our citizens as have claims on Spain of the character described will, it is presumed, be very satisfactory to them, and the boundary which is established between the territories of the parties westward of the Mississippi, heretofore in dispute, has, it is thought, been settled in conditions just and advantageous to both. But to the acquisition of Florida too much importance cannot be attached. It secures to the United States a territory important in itself, and whose importance is much increased by its bearing on many of the highest interests of the Union. It opens to several of the neighboring states a free passage to the ocean, through the province ceded by several rivers, having their sources high up within their limits. It secures us against all future annoyance from powerful Indian tribes. It gives us several excellent harbors in the Gulf of Mexico for ships of war of the largest size. It covers by its position in the Gulf the Mississippi and other great waters within our extended limits, and thereby enables the United States to afford complete protection to the vast and very valuable productions of our whole western country, which find a market through those streams. By a treaty with the British government, bearing date on the 20th of October, 1818, the Convention regulating the commerce between the United States and Great Britain, concluded in the 3rd of July, 1815, which was about expiring, was revived and continued for the term of 10 years from the time of its expiration. By that treaty, also, the differences which had arisen under the Treaty of Ghent respecting the right claimed by the United States for their citizens to take and cure fish in the coast of His Britannic Majesty's dominions in America, with other differences in important interests, were adjusted to the satisfaction of both parties. No agreement has yet been entered into respecting the commerce between the United States and the British dominions in the West Indies and in this continent. The restraints imposed in that commerce by Great Britain, and reciprocated by the United States in a principle of defense, continue still in force. A negotiation with France for the regulation of the commercial relations between the two countries, which in the course of the last summer had been commenced at Paris, has since been transferred to this city, and will be pursued in the part of the United States in the spirit of conciliation, and with an earnest desire that it may terminate in an arrangement satisfactory to both parties. Our relations with the Barbary powers are preserved in the same state and by the same means that were employed when I came into this office. As early as 1801 it was found necessary to send a squadron into the Mediterranean for the protection of our commerce, and no period has intervened, a short term excepted, when it was thought advisable to withdraw it. The great interests which the United States have in the Pacific, in commerce and in the fisheries, have also made it necessary to maintain a naval force there. In disposing of this force in both instances the most effectual measures in our power have been taken, without interfering with its other duties, for the suppression of the slave trade and of piracy in the neighboring seas. The situation of the United States in regard to their resources, the extent of their revenue, and the facility with which it is raised affords a most gratifying spectacle. The payment of nearly $67 million of the public debt, with the great progress made in measures of defense and in other improvements of various kinds since the late war, are conclusive proofs of this extraordinary prosperity, especially when it is recollected that these expenditures have been defrayed without a burthen in the people, the direct tax and excise having been repealed soon after the conclusion of the late war, and the revenue applied to these great objects having been raised in a manner not to be felt. Point. Our great resources therefore remain untouched for any purpose which may affect the vital interests of the nation. For all such purposes they are inexhaustible. They are more especially to be found in the virtue, patriotism, and intelligence of our fellow citizens, and in the devotion with which they would yield up by any just measure of taxation all their property in support of the rights and honor of their country. Under the present depression of prices, affecting all the productions of the country and every branch of industry, proceeding from causes explained in a former occasion, the revenue has considerably diminished, the effect of which has been to compel Congress either to abandon these great measures of defense or to resort to loans or internal taxes to supply the deficiency. In the presumption that this depression and the deficiency in the revenue arising from it would be temporary, loans were authorized for the demands of the last and present year. Anxious to relieve my fellow citizens in 1817 from every burthen which could be dispensed with, and the state of the treasury permitting it, I recommended the repeal of the internal taxes, knowing that such relief was then peculiarly necessary in consequence of the great exertions made in the late war. I made that recommendation under a pledge that should the public exigencies require a recurrence to them at any time, while I remained in this trust, I would with equal promptitude perform the duty which would then be alike incumbent on me. By the experiment now making it will be seen by the next session of Congress, whether the revenue shall have been so augmented as to be adequate to all these necessary purposes. Should the deficiency still continue, and especially should it be probable that it would be permanent, the course to be pursued appears to me to be obvious. I am satisfied that under certain circumstances loans may be resorted to with great advantage. I am equally well satisfied, as a general rule, that the demands of the current year, especially in time of peace, should be provided for by the revenue of that year. I have never dreaded, nor have I ever shunned, in any situation in which I have been placed, making appeals to the virtue and patriotism of my fellow citizens, well knowing that they could never be made in vain, especially in times of great emergency or for purposes of high national importance. Independently of the exigency of the case, many considerations of great weight urge a policy having in view a provision of revenue to meet to a certain extent the demands of the nation, without relying altogether on the precarious resource of foreign commerce. I am satisfied that internal duties and excises, with corresponding imposts on foreign articles of the same kind, would, without imposing any serious burdens in the people, enhance the price of produce, promote our manufactures, and augment the revenue, at the same time that they made it more secure and permanent. The care of the Indian tribes within our limits has long been an essential part of our system, but, unfortunately, it has not been executed in a manner to accomplish all the objects intended by it. We have treated them as independent nations, without their having any substantial pretensions to that rank. The distinction has flattered their pride, retarded their improvement, and in many instances paved the way to their destruction. The progress of our settlements westward, supported, as they are by a dense population, has constantly driven them back, with almost the total sacrifice of the lands which they have been compelled to abandon. They have claims on the magnanimity and, I may add, in the justice of this nation which we must all feel. We should become their real benefactors, we should perform the office of their great father, the enduring title which they emphatically give to the chief magistrate of our Union. Their sovereignty over vast territories should cease, in lieu of which the right of soil should be secured to each individual and his posterity in competent portions, and for the territory thus ceded by each tribe some reasonable equivalent should be granted, to be vested in permanent funds for the support of civil government over them and for the education of their children, for their instruction in the arts of husbandry, and to provide sustenance for them, until they could provide it for themselves. My earnest hope is that Congress will digest some plan founded in these principles, with such improvements, as their wisdom may suggest, and carry it into effect as soon as it may be practicable. Europe is again unsettled and the prospect of war increasing. Should the flame light up in any quarter, how far it may extend it is impossible to foresee. It is our peculiar felicity to be altogether unconnected with the causes which produce this menacing aspect elsewhere. With every power we are in perfect amity, and it is our interest to remain so, if it be practicable on just conditions. I see no reasonable cause to apprehend variance with any power, unless it proceed from a violation of our maritime rights. In these contests, should they occur, and to whatever extent they may be carried, we shall be neutral, but as a neutral power we have rights which it is our duty to maintain. For like injuries it will be incumbent on us to seek redress in a spirit of amity, in full confidence that, injuring none, none would knowingly injure us. For more imminent dangers we should be prepared, and it should always be recollected that such preparation adapted to the circumstances and sanctioned by the judgment and wishes of our constituents cannot fail to have a good effect in averting dangers of every kind. We should recollect also that the season of peace is best adapted to these preparations. If we turn our attention, fellow citizens, more immediately to the internal concerns of our country, and more especially to those in which its future welfare depends, we have every reason to anticipate the happiest results. It is now rather more than 44 years since we declared our independence, and 37 since it was acknowledged. The talents and virtues which were displayed in that great struggle were a sure presage of all that has since followed. A people who were able to surmount in their infant state such great perils would be more competent, as they rose into manhood, to repel any which they might meet in their progress. Their physical strength would be more adequate to foreign danger, and the practice of self-government, aided by the light of experience, could not fail to produce an effect equally salutary in all those questions connected with the internal organization. These favorable anticipations have been realized. In our whole system, national and state, we have shunned all the defects which unceasingly brayed in the vitals and destroyed the ancient republics. In them there were distinct orders, a nobility and a people, or the people governed in one assembly. Thus, in the one instance there was a perpetual conflict between the orders in society for the ascendancy, in which the victory of either terminated in the overthrow of the government and the ruin of the state, in the other, in which the people governed in a body, and whose dominions seldom exceeded the dimensions of a county in one of our states, a tumultuous and disorderly movement permitted only a transitory existence. In this great nation there is but one order, that of the people, whose power, by a peculiarly happy improvement of the representative principle, is transferred from them, without impairing in the slightest degree their sovereignty, to bodies of their own creation, and to persons elected by themselves, in the full extent necessary for all the purposes of free, enlightened, and efficient government. The whole system is elective, the complete sovereignty being in the people, and every officer in every department deriving his authority from and being responsible to them for his conduct. Our career has corresponded with this great outline. Perfection in our organization could not have been expected in the outset either in the national or state governments or in tracing the line between their respective powers. But no serious conflict has arisen, nor any contest but such as are managed by argument and by a fair appeal to the good sense of the people, and many of the defects which experience had clearly demonstrated in both governments have been remedied. By steadily pursuing this course in this spirit, there is every reason to believe that our system will soon attain the highest degree of perfection of which human institutions are capable, and that the movement in all its branches will exhibit such a degree of order and harmony as to command the admiration and respect of the civilized world. Our physical attainments have not been less eminent. 25 years ago the river Mississippi was shut up and our western brethren had no outlet for their commerce. What has been the progress since that time? The river has not only become the property of the United States from its source to the ocean, with all its tributary streams, with the exception of the upper part of the Red River only, but Louisiana, with a fair and liberal boundary in the western side and the Floridas in the eastern, have been ceded to us. The United States now enjoy the complete and uninterrupted sovereignty over the whole territory from St. Croix to the Sabine. New states, settled from among ourselves in this and in other parts, have been admitted into our Union in equal participation in the national sovereignty with the original states. Our population has augmented in an astonishing degree and extended in every direction. We now, fellow citizens, comprise within our limits the dimensions and faculties of a great power under a government possessing all the energies of any government ever known to the old world, with an uttering capacity to oppress the people. Entering with these views the office which I have just solemnly sworn to execute with fidelity and to the utmost of my ability, I derive great satisfaction from the knowledge that I shall be assisted in the several departments by the very enlightened and upright citizens from whom I have received so much aid in the preceding term. With full confidence in the continuance of that candor and generous indulgence from my fellow citizens at large which I have heretofore experienced, and with a firm reliance in the protection of Almighty God, I shall forthwith commence the duties of the high trust to which you have called me. March 5, 1821. Proclamations. By the President of the United States of America. A proclamation. Whereas information has been received that an atrocious murder, aggravated by the additional crime of robbery, was, in the 6th or 7th day of this present month, committed in the county of Alexandria in District of Columbia in William Sever, late of this city, and whereas the apprehension and punishment of the murderer or murderers and his or their accessory or accessories will be an example due to justice and humanity and every way salutary in its operation, I have therefore thought fit to issue this my proclamation, hereby exhorting the citizens of the United States, and particularly those of this district, and requiring all officers, according to their respective stations, to use their utmost endeavors to apprehend and bring the principal or principals, accessory or accessories, to the said murder to justice. And I do moreover offer a reward of $300 for each principal, if there be more than one, and $150 for each accessory before the fact, if there be more than one, who shall be apprehended after the day of the date hereof and brought to justice, to be paid upon his conviction of the crime or crimes aforesaid. In testimony whereof I have caused the seal of the United States to be affixed to these presents, and signed the same with my hand. ~SEAL~ Done at the City of Washington, this 10th day of July, A.D. 1821, and of the Independence of the United States the 46th. James Monroe. By the President, John Quincy Adams, Secretary of State. By the President of the United States. A Proclamation. Whereas the Congress of the United States, by a joint resolution of the 2nd day of March last, entitled Resolution Providing for the Admission of the State of Missouri into the Union in a Certain Condition, did determine and declare that Missouri should be admitted into this Union on an equal footing with the original states in all respects whatever upon the fundamental condition that the 4th clause of the 26th section of the 3rd article of the Constitution submitted in the part of said state to Congress shall never be construed to authorize the passage of any law, and that no law shall be passed in conformity thereto, by which any citizen of either of the states of this Union shall be excluded from the enjoyment of any of the privileges and immunities to which such citizen is entitled under the Constitution of the United States, provided that the legislature of said state, by a solemn public act, shall declare the assent of the said state to the said fundamental condition, and shall transmit to the President of the United States on or before the first Monday in November next an authentic copy of said act, upon the receipt whereof the President, by proclamation, shall announce the fact, whereupon, and without any further proceeding on the part of Congress, the admission of the said state into this Union shall be considered as complete, and whereas by a solemn public act of the Assembly of said State of Missouri, passed on the 26th of June, in the present year, entitled A Solemn Public Act Declaring the Assent of this State to the Fundamental Condition Contained in a Resolution Passed by the Congress of the United States Providing for the Admission of the State of Missouri into the Union in a Certain Condition, an authentic copy whereof has been communicated to me. It is solemnly and publicly enacted and declared that that state has assented, and does assent, that the fourth clause of the 26th section of the third article of the Constitution of said state shall never be construed to authorize the passage of any law, and that no law shall be passed in conformity thereto, by which any citizen of either of the United States shall be excluded from the enjoyment of any of the privileges and immunities to which such citizens are entitled under the Constitution of the United States. Now, therefore, I, James Monroe, President of the United States, in pursuance of the resolution of Congress aforesaid, have issued this my proclamation, announcing the fact that the said state of Missouri has assented to the fundamental condition required by the resolution of Congress aforesaid, whereupon the admission of the said state of Missouri into this Union is declared to be complete. In testimony whereof I have caused the seal of the United States of America to be affixed to these presents, and signed the same with my hand. Left square bracket seal right square bracket. Done at the city of Washington, the 10th day of August, A.D. 1821, and of the independence of the said United States of America the 46th. James Monroe. By the President, John Quincy Adams, Secretary of State. By the President of the United States of America. A proclamation. Whereas by an act of the Congress of the United States of the 3rd of March, 1815, so much of the several acts imposing duties on the ships and vessels and in goods, wares, and merchandise imported into the United States, has imposed a discriminating duty of tonnage between foreign vessels and vessels of the United States and between goods imported into the United States in foreign vessels and vessels of the United States were repealed so far, as the same respected the produce or manufacture of the nation to which such foreign ship or vessel might belong, such repeal to take effect in favor of any foreign nation, whenever the President of the United States should be satisfied that the discriminating or countervailing duties of such foreign nation so far, as they operate to the disadvantage of the United States have been abolished, and whereas satisfactory proof has been received by me, through the charged affair of the United States in Sweden, under date of the 30th day of January, 1821, that thenceforward all discriminating or countervailing duties in the Kingdom of Norway so far, as they operated to the disadvantage of the United States had been and were abolished. Now, therefore, I, James Monroe, President of the United States of America, do hereby declare and proclaim that so much of the several acts imposing duties on the tonnage of ships and vessels and in goods, wares, and merchandise imported into the United States, has imposed a discriminating duty of tonnage between vessels of the Kingdom of Norway and vessels of the United States and between goods imported into the United States in vessels of the said Kingdom of Norway and vessels of the United States are repealed so far as the same respect the produce or manufacture of the said Kingdom of Norway, given under my hand, at the city of Washington, this 20th day of August, A.D. 1821, and the 46th year of the independence of the United States. James Monroe. By the President, John Quincy Adams, Secretary of State. By the President of the United States of America. A proclamation. Whereas by an act of the Congress of the United States of the 3rd of March, 1815, so much of the several acts imposing duties on the ships and vessels and in goods, wares, and merchandise imported into the United States, has imposed a discriminating duty of tonnage between foreign vessels and vessels of the United States and between goods imported into the United States in foreign vessels and vessels of the United States were repealed so far, has the same respected the producer or manufacturer of the nation to which such foreign ship or vessel might belong, such repeal to take effect in favor of any foreign nation, whenever the President of the United States should be satisfied that the discriminating or countervailing duties of such foreign nation so far as they operate to the disadvantage of the United States have been abolished, and whereas satisfactory proof has been received by me, under date of the 11th of May last, that thenceforward all discriminating or countervailing duties of the Dukedom of Oldenburg so far as they might operate to the disadvantage of the United States should be and were abolished upon His Highness the Duke of Oldenburg's being duly certified of a reciprocal act in the part of the United States. Now, therefore, I, James Monroe, President of the United States of America, do hereby declare and proclaim that so much of the several acts imposing duties on the tonnage of ships and vessels and in goods, wares, and merchandise imported into the United States, has imposed a discriminating duty of tonnage between vessels of the Dukedom of Oldenburg and vessels of the United States and between goods imported into the United States in vessels of the said Dukedom of Oldenburg and vessels of the United States are repealed so far as the same respect the producer or manufacturer of the said Dukedom of Oldenburg given under my hand, at the city of Washington, this 22nd day of November, A.D. 1821, and the 46th year of the independence of the United States. James Monroe. By the President, John Quincy Adams, Secretary of State. Fifth Annual Message. Washington, December 3rd, 1821. Fellow citizens of the Senate and of the House of Representatives. The progress of our affairs since the last session has been such as may justly be claimed and expected under a government deriving all its powers from an enlightened people, and under laws formed by their representatives, in great consideration, for the sole purpose of promoting the welfare and happiness of their constituents. In the execution of those laws and of the powers vested by the Constitution in the executive, unremitted attention has been paid to the great objects to which they extend. In the concerns which are exclusively internal, there is good cause to be satisfied with the result. The laws have had their due operation and effect. In those relating to foreign powers, I am happy to state that peace and amity are preserved with all by a strict observance in both sides of the rights of each. In matters touching our commercial intercourse, where a difference of opinion has existed as to the conditions in which it should be placed, each party has pursued its own policy without giving just cause of offense to the other. In this annual communication, especially, when it is addressed to a new Congress, the whole scope of our political concerns naturally comes into view, that errors, if such have been committed, may be corrected, that defects which have become manifest may be remedied, and, in the other hand, that measures which were adopted in due deliberation, and which experience has shown are just in themselves and essential to the public welfare, should be persevered in and supported. In performing this necessary and very important duty, I shall endeavor to place before you in its merits every subject that is thought to be entitled to your particular attention in as distinct and clear a light as I may be able. By an act of the 3rd of March, 1815, so much of the several acts has imposed higher duties in the tonnage of foreign vessels and in the manufactures and productions of foreign nations when imported into the United States in foreign vessels than when imported in vessels of the United States were repealed so far as respected the manufactures and productions of the nation to which such vessels belonged, in the condition that the repeal should take effect only in favor of any foreign nation, when the executive should be satisfied that such discriminating duties to the disadvantage of the United States had likewise been repealed by such nation. By this act a proposition was made to all nations to place our commerce with each on a basis which it was presumed would be acceptable to all. Every nation was allowed to bring its manufactures and productions into our ports and to take the manufactures and productions of the United States back to their ports in their own vessels in the same conditions that they might be transported in vessels of the United States. And in return it was required that a like accommodation should be granted to the vessels of the United States in the ports of other powers. The articles to be admitted or prohibited in either side formed no part of the proposed arrangement. Each party would retain the right to admit or prohibit such articles from the other, as it thought proper, and in its own conditions. When the nature of the commerce between the United States and every other country was taken into view, it was thought that this proposition would be considered fair, and even liberal, by every power. The exports of the United States consist generally of articles of the first necessity and of rude materials in demand for foreign manufactories, of great bulk, requiring for their transportation many vessels, the return for which in the manufactures and productions of any foreign country, even when disposed of thereto advantage, may be brought in a single vessel. This observation is the more especially applicable to those countries from which manufactures alone are imported, but it applies in a great extent to the European dominions of every European power and in a certain extent to all the colonies of those powers. By placing, then, the navigation precisely in the same ground in the transportation of exports and imports between the United States and other countries, it was presumed that all was offered which could be desired. It seemed to be the only proposition which could be devised which would retain even the semblance of equality in our favor. Many considerations of great weight gave us a right to expect that this commerce should be extended to the colonies as well as to the European dominions of other powers. With the latter, especially with countries exclusively manufacturing, the advantage was manifestly on their side. An indemnity for that loss was expected from a trade with the colonies, and with the greater reason, as it was known that the supplies which the colonies derived from us were of the highest importance to them, their labor being bestowed with so much greater profit in the culture of other articles, and because, likewise, the articles of which those supplies consisted, forming so large a proportion of the exports of the United States, were never admitted into any of the ports of Europe, except in cases of great emergency to avert a serious calamity. When no article is admitted which is not required to supply the wants of the party admitting it, and admitted then not in favor of any particular country to the disadvantage of others, but on conditions equally applicable to all, it seems just that the articles thus admitted and invited should be carried thither in the vessels of the country affording such supply, and that the reciprocity should be found in a corresponding accommodation on the other side. By allowing each party to participate in the transportation of such supplies in the payment of equal tonnage, a strong proof was afforded of an accommodating spirit. To abandon to it the transportation of the whole would be a sacrifice which ought not to be expected. The demand in the present instance would be the more unreasonable in consideration of the great inequality existing in the trade with the parent country. Such was the basis of our system, as established by the Act of 1815, and such its true character. In the year in which this act was passed, a treaty was concluded with Great Britain, in strict conformity with its principles, in regard to her European dominions. To her colonies, however, in the West Indies and in this continent it was not extended, the British government claiming the exclusive supply of those colonies, and from our own ports, and of the productions of the colonies in return in her own vessels. To this claim the United States could not assent, and in consequence each party suspended the intercourse in the vessels of the other by a prohibition which still exists. The same conditions were offered to France, but not accepted. Her government has demanded other conditions more favorable to her navigation, and which should also give extraordinary encouragement to her manufactures and productions in ports of the United States. To these it was thought improper to accede, and in consequence the restricted regulations which had been adopted in her part being countervailed in the part of the United States, the direct commerce between the two countries in the vessels of each party has been in a great measure suspended. It is much to be regretted that, although a negotiation has been long pending, such is the diversity of views entertained in the various points which have been brought into discussion that there does not appear to be any reasonable prospect of its early conclusion. It is my duty to state, as a cause of very great regret, that very serious differences have occurred in this negotiation respecting the construction of the 8th article of the Treaty of 1803. By which Louisiana was ceded to the United States, and likewise respecting the seizure of the Apollo, in 1820, for a violation of our revenue laws. The claim of the government of France has excited not less surprise than concern, because there does not appear to be a just foundation for it in either instance. By the 8th article of the treaty referred to it is stipulated that after the expiration of 12 years, during which time it was provided by the 7th or preceding article that the vessels of France and Spain should be admitted into the ports of the ceded territory without paying higher duties in merchandise or tonnage in the vessels than such as were paid by citizens of the United States. The ships of France should forever afterwards be placed on the footing of the most favored nation. By the obvious construction of this article it is presumed that it was intended that no favor should be granted to any power in those ports to which France should not be forthwith entitled, nor should any accommodation be allowed to another power in conditions to which she would not also be entitled in the same conditions. Under this construction no favor or accommodation could be granted to any power to the prejudice of France. By allowing the equivalent allowed by those powers she would always stand in those ports in the footing of the most favored nation. But if this article should be so construed, as that France should enjoy, of right, and without paying the equivalent, all the advantages of such conditions, as might be allowed to other powers in return for important concessions made by them, then the whole character of the stipulation would be changed. She would not be placed on the footing of the most favored nation, but on a footing held by no other nation. She would enjoy all advantages allowed to them in consideration of like advantages allowed to us, free from every and any condition whatever. As little cause has the government of France to complain of the seizure of the Apollo and the removal of other vessels from the waters of the St. Mary's. It will not be denied that every nation has a right to regulate its commercial system, as it thinks fit and to enforce the collection of its revenue, provided it be done without an invasion of the rights of other powers. The violation of its revenue laws is an offense which all nations punish, the punishment of which gives no just cause of complaint to the power to which the offenders belong, provided it be extended to all equally. In this case every circumstance which occurred indicated a fixed purpose to violate our revenue laws. Had the party intended to have pursued a fair trade he would have entered our ports and paid the duties, or had he intended to carry on a legitimate circuitous commerce with the United States he would have entered the port of some other power, landed his goods at the custom house according to law, and reshipped and sent them in the vessel of such power, or of some other power which might lawfully bring them, free from such duties, to a port of the United States. But the conduct of the party in this case was altogether different. He entered the River St. Mary's, the boundary line between the United States and Florida, and took his position in the Spanish side, in which in the whole extent of the river there was no town, no port or custom house, and scarcely any settlement. His purpose, therefore, was not to sell his goods to the inhabitants of Florida, but to citizens of the United States, in exchange for their productions, which could not be done without a direct and palpable breach on our laws. It is known that a regular systematic plan had been formed by certain persons for the violation of our revenue system, which made it the more necessary to check the proceeding in its commencement. That the unsettled bank of a river so remote from the Spanish garrisons and population could give no protection to any party in such a practice is believed to be in strict accord with the law of nations. It would not have comported with a friendly policy in Spain herself to have established a custom house there, since it could have subserved no other purpose than to elude our revenue law. But the government of Spain did not adopt that measure. In the contrary, it is understood that the Captain General of Cuba, to whom an application to that effect was made by these adventurers, had not acceded to it. The condition of those provinces for many years, before they were ceded to the United States, need not now be dwelt on. Inhabited by different tribes of Indians and uninroad for every kind of adventurer, the jurisdiction of Spain may be said to have been almost exclusively confined to her garrisons. It certainly could not extend to places where she had no authority. The rules, therefore, applicable to settled countries governed by laws could not be deemed so to the deserts of Florida and to the occurrences there. It merits attention also that the territory had then been ceded to the United States by a treaty the ratification of which had not been refused, and which has since been performed. Under any circumstances, therefore, Spain became less responsible for such acts committed there, and the United States more at liberty to exercise authority to prevent so great a mischief. The conduct of this government has in every instance been conciliatory and friendly to France. The construction of our revenue law in its application to the cases which have formed the ground of such serious complaint on her part and the order to the collector of St. Mary's, in accord with it, were given 2 years before these cases occurred, and in reference to a breach which was attempted by the subjects of another power. The application, therefore, to the cases in question was inevitable. As soon as the treaty by which these provinces were ceded to the United States was ratified, and all danger of further breach on our revenue laws ceased, an order was given for the release of the vessel which had been seized and for the dismission of the libel which had been instituted against her.
The principles of this system of reciprocity, founded in the law of the 3rd of March, 1815, have been since carried into effect with the kingdoms of the Netherlands, Sweden, Prussia, and with Hamburg, Bremen, Lübeck, and Oldenburg, with a provision made by subsequent laws in regard to the Netherlands, Prussia, Hamburg, and Bremen that such produce and manufactures, as could only be, or most usually were, first shipped from the ports of those countries, the same being imported in vessels wholly belonging to their subjects, should be considered and admitted as their own manufactures and productions. The government of Norway has by an ordinance opened the ports of that part of the dominions of the King of Sweden to the vessels of the United States upon the payment of no other or higher duties than are paid by Norwegian vessels, from whatever place arriving and with whatever articles laden. They have requested the reciprocal allowance for the vessels of Norway in the ports of the United States. As this privilege is not within the scope of the Act of the 3rd of March, 1815, and can only be granted by Congress, and as it may involve the commercial relations of the United States with other nations, the subject is submitted to the wisdom of Congress. I have presented thus fully to your view our commercial relations with other powers, that, seeing them in detail with each power, and knowing the basis in which they rest, Congress may in its wisdom decide whether any change ought to be made, and, if any, in what respect. If this basis is unjust or unreasonable, surely it ought to be abandoned, but if it be just and reasonable, and any change in it will make concessions subversive of equality and tending in its consequences to sap the foundations of our prosperity, then the reasons are equally strong for adhering to the ground already taken, and supporting it by such further regulations as may appear to be proper, should any additional support be found necessary. The question concerning the construction of the first article of the Treaty of Ghent has been, by a joint act of the representatives of the United States and of Great Britain at the Court of St. Petersburg, submitted to the decision of His Imperial Majesty the Emperor of Russia. The result of that submission has not yet been received. The commissioners under the fifth article of that treaty not having been able to agree upon their decision, their reports to the two governments, according to the provisions of the treaty, may be expected at an early day. With Spain the treaty of February 22, 1819, has been partly carried into execution. Possession of East and West Florida has been given to the United States, but the officers charged with that service by an order from His Catholic Majesty, delivered by his minister to the Secretary of State, and transmitted by a special agent to the Captain General of Cuba, to whom it was directed and in whom the government of those provinces was vested, have not only omitted, in contravention of the order of their sovereign, the performance of the express stipulation to deliver over the archives and documents relating to the property and sovereignty of those provinces, all of which it was expected would have been delivered either before or when the troops were withdrawn, but defeated, since every effort of the United States to obtain them, especially those of the greatest importance. This omission has given rise to several incidents of a painful nature, the character of which will be fully disclosed by the documents which will be hereafter communicated. In every other circumstance the law of the 3rd of March last, for carrying into effect that treaty, has been duly attended to. For the execution of that part which preserved in force, for the government of the inhabitants for the term specified, all the civil, military, and judicial powers exercised by the existing government of those provinces an adequate number of officers, as was presumed, were appointed, and ordered to their respective stations. Both provinces were formed into one territory, and a governor appointed for it, but in consideration of the pre-existing division and of the distance and difficulty of communication between Pensacola, the residence of the governor of West Florida, and St. Augustine, that of the governor of East Florida, at which places the inconsiderable population of each province was principally collected, two secretaries were appointed, the one to reside at Pensacola and the other at St. Augustine. Due attention was likewise paid to the execution of the laws of the United States relating to the revenue and the slave trade, which were extended to these provinces. The whole territory was divided into three collection districts, that part lying between the River St. Mary's and Cape Florida forming one, that from the Cape to the Apalachicola another, and that from the Apalachicola to the Perdido the third. To these districts the usual number of revenue officers were appointed, and to secure the due operation of these laws, one judge and a district attorney were appointed to reside at Pensacola, and likewise one judge and a district attorney to reside at St. Augustine, with a specified boundary between them, and one marshal for the whole, with authority to appoint a deputy. In carrying this law into effect, and especially that part relating to the powers of the existing government of those provinces, it was thought important, in consideration of the short term for which it was to operate and the radical change which would be made at the approaching session of Congress, to avoid expense, to make no appointment which should not be absolutely necessary to give effect to those powers, to withdraw none of our citizens from their pursuits, whereby to subject the government to claims which could not be gratified and the parties to losses which it would be painful to witness. It has been seen with much concern that in the performance of these duties a collision arose between the governor of the territory and the judge appointed for the Western District. It was presumed that the law under which this transitory government was organized, and the commissions which were granted to the officers who were appointed to execute each branch of the system, and to which the commissions were adapted, would have been understood in the same sense by them in which they were understood by the executive. Much allowance is due to officers employed in each branch of this system, and the more so, as there is good cause to believe that each acted under the conviction that he possessed the power which he undertook to exercise. Of the officer holding the principal station, I think it proper to observe that he accepted it with reluctance, in compliance with the invitation given him, and from a high sense of duty to his country, being willing to contribute to the consummation of an event which would ensure complete protection to an important part of our Union, which had suffered much from incursion and invasion, and to the defense of which his very gallant and patriotic services had been so signally and usefully devoted. From the intrinsic difficulty of executing laws deriving their origin from different sources, and so essentially different in many important circumstances, the advantage, and indeed the necessity, of establishing as soon as may be practicable a well-organized government over that territory in the principles of our system is apparent. This subject is therefore recommended to the early consideration of Congress. In compliance with an injunction of the law of the 3rd of March last, three commissioners have also been appointed and a board organized for carrying into effect the 11th article of the treaty above recited, making provision for the payment of such of our citizens as have well-founded claims in Spain of the character specified by that treaty. This board has entered in its duties and made some progress therein. The commissioner and surveyor of His Catholic Majesty, provided for by the 4th article of the treaty, have not yet arrived in the United States, but are soon expected. As soon as they do arrive, corresponding appointments will be made and every facility be afforded for the due execution of this service. The government of His Most Faithful Majesty, since the termination of the last session of Congress, has been removed from Rio de Janeiro to Lisbon, where a revolution similar to that which had occurred in the neighboring kingdom of Spain had in like manner been sanctioned by the accepted and pledged faith of the reigning monarch. The diplomatic intercourse between the United States and the Portuguese dominions, interrupted by this important event, has not yet been resumed, but the change of internal administration having already materially affected the commercial intercourse of the United States with the Portuguese dominions, the renewal of the public missions between the two countries appears to be desirable at an early day. It is understood that the colonies in South America have had great success during the present year in the struggle for their independence. The new government of Colombia has extended its territories and considerably augmented its strength, and at Buenos Aires, where civil dissensions had for some time before prevailed, greater harmony and better order appear to have been established. Equal success has attended their efforts in the provinces in the Pacific. It has long been manifest that it would be impossible for Spain to reduce these colonies by force, and equally so that no conditions short of their independence would be satisfactory to them. It may therefore be presumed, and it is earnestly hoped, that the government of Spain, guided by enlightened and liberal counsels, will find it to comport with its interests and due to its magnanimity to terminate this exhausting controversy on that basis. To promote this result by friendly counsel with the government of Spain will be the object of the government of the United States. In conducting the fiscal operations of the year, it has been found necessary to carry into full effect the act of the last session of Congress authorizing a loan of $5 million. This sum has been raised at an average premium of $5.59 per centum upon stock bearing an interest at the rate of 5% per annum, redeemable at the option of the government after the first day of January, 1835. There has been issued under the provisions of this Act $4,735,296.30 of 5% stock, and there has been or will be redeemed during the year $3,197,030.71 of Louisiana 6% deferred stock and Mississippi stock. There has therefore been a natural increase of the public debt contracted during the year of $1,538,266.69. The receipts into the Treasury from the 1st of January to the 30th of September last have amounted to $16,219,197.70, which, with a balance of $1,198,461.21 in the Treasury in the former day, make the aggregate sum of $17,417,658.91. The payments from the Treasury during the same period have amounted to $15,655,288.47, leaving in the Treasury in the last mentioned day the sum of $1,762,370.44. It is estimated that the receipts of the fourth quarter of the year will exceed the demands which will be made in the Treasury during the same period, and that the amount in the Treasury on the 30th of September last will be increased on the first day of January next. At the close of the last session, it was anticipated that the progressive diminution of the public revenue in 1819 and 1820, which had been the result of the languid state of our foreign commerce in those years, had in the latter year reached its extreme point of depression. It has, however, been ascertained that that point was reached only at the termination of the first quarter of the present year. From that time until the 30th of September last, the duties secured have exceeded those of the corresponding quarters of the last year $1,172,000, whilst the amount of debentures issued during the three first quarters of this year is $952,000 less than that of the same quarters of the last year. There are just grounds to believe that the improvement which has occurred in the revenue during the last mentioned period will not only be maintained, but that it will progressively increase through the next and several succeeding years, so as to realize the results which were presented upon that subject by the official reports of the Treasury at the commencement of the last session of Congress. Under the influence of the most unfavorable circumstances, the revenue for the next and subsequent years to the year 1825 will exceed the demands at present authorized by law. It may fairly be presumed that under the protection given to domestic manufacturers by the existing laws, we shall become at no distant period a manufacturing country on an extensive scale, possessing, as we do, the raw materials in such vast amount, with the capacity to augment them to an indefinite extent, raising within the country aliment of every kind to an amount far exceeding the demand for home consumption, even in the most unfavorable years, and to be obtained always at a very moderate price, skilled also, as our people are, in the mechanic arts and in every improvement calculated to lessen the demand for and the price of labor, it is manifest that their success in every branch of domestic industry may and will be carried, under the encouragement given by the present duties, to an extent to meet any demand which under a fair competition may be made upon it. A considerable increase of domestic manufactures, by diminishing the importation of foreign, will probably tend to lessen the amount of the public revenue. As, however, a large proportion of the revenue which is derived from duties is raised from other articles than manufactures, the demand for which will increase with our population, it is believed that a fund will still be raised from that source adequate to the greater part of the public expenditures, especially as those expenditures, should we continue to be blessed with peace, will be diminished by the completion of the fortifications, dockyards, and other public works, by the augmentation of the navy to the point to which it is proposed to carry it, and by the payment of the public debt, including pensions for military services. It cannot be doubted that the more complete our internal resources and the less dependent we are on foreign powers for every national as well as domestic purpose, the greater and more stable will be the public felicity. By the increase of domestic manufactures will the demand for the rude materials at home be increased, and thus will the dependence of the several parts of our Union in each other and the strength of the Union itself be proportionably augmented. In this process, which is very desirable and inevitable under the existing duties, the resources which obviously present themselves to supply deficiency in the revenue, should it occur, are the interests which may derive the principal benefit from the change. If domestic manufactures are raised by duties on foreign, the deficiency in the fund necessary for public purposes should be supplied by duties in the former. At the last session it seemed doubtful whether the revenue derived from the present sources would be adequate to all the great purposes of our Union, including the construction of our fortifications, the augmentation of the navy, and the protection of our commerce against the dangers to which it is exposed. Had the deficiency been such as to subject us to the necessity either to abandon those measures of defense or to resort to other means for adequate funds, the course presented to the adoption of a virtuous and enlightened people appeared to be a plain one. It must be gratifying to all to know that this necessity does not exist. Nothing, however, in contemplation of such important objects, which can be easily provided for, should be left to hazard. It is thought that the revenue may receive an augmentation from the existing sources, and in a manner to aid our manufacturers, without hastening prematurely the result which has been suggested. It is believed that a moderate additional duty in certain articles would have that effect, without being liable to any serious objection. The examination of the whole coast, for the construction of permanent fortifications, from St. Croix to the Sabine, with the exception of part of the territory lately acquired, will be completed in the present year, as will be the survey of the Mississippi, under the resolution of the House of Representatives, from the mouth of the Ohio to the ocean, and likewise of the Ohio from Louisville to the Mississippi.
A progress corresponding with the sums appropriated has also been made in the construction of these fortifications at the points designated, as they will form a system of defense for the whole maritime frontier, and in consequence for the interior, and are to last for ages. The greatest care has been taken to fix the position of each work and to form it on such a scale as will be adequate to the purpose intended by it. All the inlets and assailable parts of our Union have been minutely examined, and positions taken with a view to the best effect, observing in every instance a just regard for economy. Doubts, however, being entertained as to the propriety of the position and extent of the work at Dauphin Island, further progress in it was suspended soon after the last session of Congress, and an order given to the Board of Engineers and Naval Commissioners to make a further and more minute examination of it in both respects, and to report the result without delay. Due progress has been made in the construction of vessels of war according to the law providing for the gradual augmentation of the Navy, and to the extent of existing appropriations. The vessels authorized by the Act of 1820 have all been completed and are now in actual service. None of the larger ships have been or will be launched for the present, the object being to protect all which may not be required for immediate service from decay by suitable buildings erected over them. A squadron has been maintained, as heretofore, in the Mediterranean, by means whereof peace has been preserved with the Barbary powers. This squadron has been reduced the present year to as small a force as is compatible with the fulfillment of the object intended by it. From past experience and the best information respecting the views of those powers, it is distinctly understood that should our squadron be withdrawn, they would soon recommence their hostilities and depredations upon our commerce. Their fortifications have lately been rebuilt and their maritime force increased. It has also been found necessary to maintain a naval force in the Pacific for the protection of the very important interests of our citizens engaged in commerce and the fisheries in that sea. Vessels have likewise been employed in cruising along the Atlantic coast, in the Gulf of Mexico, in the coast of Africa, and in the neighboring seas. In the latter, many piracies have been committed in our commerce, and so extensive was becoming the range of those unprincipled adventurers that there was cause to apprehend, without a timely and decisive effort to suppress them, the worst consequences would ensue. Fortunately, a considerable check has been given to that spirit by our cruisers, who have succeeded in capturing and destroying several of their vessels. Nevertheless, it is considered an object of high importance to continue these cruises until the practice is entirely suppressed. Like success has attended our efforts to suppress the slave trade. Under the flag of the United States and the sanction of their papers, the trade may be considered as entirely suppressed, and if any of our citizens are engaged in it under the flags and papers of other powers, it is only from the respect to the rights of those powers that these offenders are not seized and brought home to receive the punishment which the laws inflict. If every other power should adopt the same policy and pursue the same vigorous means for carrying it into effect, the trade could no longer exist. Deeply impressed with the blessings which we enjoy, and of which we have such manifold proofs, my mind is irresistibly drawn to that almighty being, the great source from whence they proceed, and to whom our most grateful acknowledgments are due. James Monroe. Special Messages. Washington, December 16, 1821. To the Senate and House of Representatives of the United States. I transmit to Congress a letter from the Secretary of the Treasury, enclosing the report of the commissioners appointed in conformity with the provisions of an act to authorize the building of lighthouses therein mentioned,
and for other purposes, approved the 3rd of March, 1821. James Monroe, Washington, December 16, 1821. To the House of Representatives of the United States. By a resolution of Congress approved in the 27th of March, 1818, it was directed that the journal, acts, and proceedings of the convention which formed the present Constitution of the United States should be published, under the direction of the President of the United States, together with the secret journals of the acts and proceedings, and the foreign correspondence, with a certain exception, of the Congress of the United States from the first meeting thereof down to the date of the ratification of the definitive treaty of peace between Great Britain and the United States, in the year 1783, and that 1,000 copies thereof should be printed, of which one copy should be furnished to each member of that, the 15th, Congress, and the residue should remain subject to the future disposition of Congress. And by a resolution of Congress approved in the 21st April, 1820, it was provided that the secret journal, together with all the papers and documents connected with that journal, and all other papers and documents heretofore considered confidential, of the old Congress, from the date of the ratification of the definitive treaty of the year 1783 to the formation of the present government, which were remaining in the office of the Secretary of State, should be published under the direction of the President of the United States, and that I 0 copies thereof should be printed and deposited in the library subject to the disposition of Congress. In pursuance of these two resolutions, 1,000 copies of the journals and acts of the convention which formed the Constitution have been heretofore printed and placed at the disposal of Congress, and 1,000 copies of the secret journals of the Congress of the Confederation, complete, have been printed, 250 copies of which have been reserved to comply with the direction of furnishing one copy to each member of the 15th Congress. The remaining 750 copies have been deposited in the library and are now at the disposal of Congress. By the General Appropriation Act of 9th April, 1818, the sum of $10,000 was appropriated for defraying the expenses of printing done pursuant to the resolution of the 27th of March of that year. No appropriation has yet been made to defray the expenses incident to the execution of the resolution of 21st April, 1820. The whole expense hitherto incurred in carrying both resolutions into effect has exceeded by $542.56 the appropriation of April, 1818. This balance remains due to the printers, and is included in the estimates of appropriation for the year 1822. That part of the resolution of the 27th of March, 1818, which directs the publication of the foreign correspondence of the Congress of the Confederation remains yet to be executed, and a further appropriation will be necessary for carrying it into effect. James Monroe, December 30th, 1821. To the Senate of the United States. I transmit to the Senate a treaty of peace and amity concluded between the United States and the Dey and Regency of Algiers on the 23rd of December, 1816. This treaty is in all respects the same in its provisions with that which had been concluded in the 30th of June, 1815, and was ratified by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, in the 26th of December of that year, with the exception of one additional and explanatory article. The circumstances which have occasioned the delay in laying the present treaty before the Senate for their advice and consent to its ratification are, that having been received in the spring of the year 1817, during the recess of the Senate, In the interval between the time when the Department of State was vacated by its late secretary and the entrance of his successor upon the duties of the office, and when a change also occurred of the chief clerk of the department, it was not recollected by the officers of the department that it remained without the constitutional sanction of the Senate until shortly before the commencement of the present session. The documents explanatory of the additional articles are likewise herewith transmitted. James Monroe.